Tonight we continue our remembrance of the Holy Innocents by considering others who have been and may yet be slaughtered in power struggles past, present, and future. The title of this session is Counterforce, that is defined as nuclear missiles aimed at strategic military targets rather than at population and industrial centers. To explore the implications of such a policy, I wish to review a bit of the history of how we got where we are today. First, a disclaimer. I have no military experience whatsoever, unless you want to count being married to an ex-Marine. So, any information that I have has been gained from the half dozen books I read this fall and dozens of articles I've gathered through the years. Any of you may have specialized knowledge about any subject I bring in. Please be free to join in when that happens. On August 6, 1945, at 8:16 a.m., the nature of warfare was forever changed. Three United States B-29 bombers flew over Hiroshima, Japan. One of them dropped a bomb on a parachute. Since the all clear had sounded because only three planes were seen, many people watched it float down until it exploded 1,670 feet in the air. This single weapon had an explosive power of at least 12,000 tons of TNT, or 12 kilotons, as nuclear weapons are rated, although some recent studies suggest the power may have been somewhat larger than that. Over 5 square miles were instantly reduced to rubble. At least 140,000 people had died by the end of the year. At 11:02 a.m., 3 days later, a bomb rated at 22 kilotons was exploded over the city of Nagasaki. 2.5 square miles totally destroyed, and at least 70,000 people dead by the end of the year. The immediate deaths were caused by the force of the blast, which has half the total energy generated, and by the heat of the fireball, which is one-third of the energy, several million degrees C instantly, and 5,000 degrees C at the surface of the fireball, which spread to 400 meters across. The remaining energy causing death in the following days, weeks, and months was in the form of ionizing radiation. The source of the energy and the power of the individual weapon were new, being 5,000 times more powerful than conventional bombs of the same weight. Yet the total amount of destruction targeted upon civilian populations was not new. Two B-29 raids on Tokyo in the spring of 1945 used incendiary bombs to destroy 16 square miles of the city in a firestorm, killing some 250,000 people. The immediate effects of those two bombs are generally thought to include the surrender of Japan 2 days after the Nagasaki blast. The alternative considered invading Japan had been estimated by General MacArthur to expect to result in the deaths of 500,000 U.S. military personnel without even trying to assess the likely number of Japanese military and civilian casualties over the additional year they thought it might have taken before the war would have ended without those weapons. Why was the bomb developed? Beginning in April 1939, the German War Office was persuaded to begin work on such a weapon. It was in July 1939 that Albert Einstein sent a letter to President Roosevelt urging the U.S. to make the attempt. It was 1945 before it was clear that the Germans were not succeeding in their attempt, but by then our own project had its own momentum. John Archibald Wheeler, one of the physicists centrally involved in the project, reflects on his role. As I look back on those days, I feel a great sadness. How did it come about that I looked on fission first as a physicist and only secondarily as a citizen? Why did I not look at it first as a citizen and only secondarily as a physicist? A simple survey of the records show that between 20 and 25 million people perished in World War II, and more of them in the later years than in the earlier years. Every month by which the war was shortened would have meant a saving on the order of 500,000 to 1,000,000 lives. Among those granted life would have been my brother Joe, killed in October 1944 in the battle for Italy. What a difference it would have made if the critical date had been not August 6, 1945, but August 6, 1943. Why did I not start working full-time on uranium February 1, 1939, rather than February 1, 1942? Insufficient sense of involvement? That was it. I did not grasp that the vital interests of the United States were at stake. Would that I had understood history better. What a difference it would have made to have been pushed on by that sense of history. Would it have meant 2 months and 1,000,000 lives, or 2 years and 10 million lives? Another reason for actually using the weapon on a real target was to show the world, especially our then ally, the Soviet Union, that we had the weapon, that it worked, and that we had the will to use it. General Groves, who headed the Manhattan Project that produced the bomb, thought it would take the Soviet Union at least 20 years to develop one of their own. It took them 4 years, as they had already started. Dan Erlander, in By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb, summarizes key steps on the road of the nuclear arms race on page 3. After the Soviet Union exploded the first atomic bomb in 1949 of theirs, we exploded the first hydrogen bomb in 1952. Their first was 1953. We placed tactical nuclear weapons in Europe in 1954. They did in 1957. That same year, they had the first intercontinental ballistic missile. Ours followed a year later. We had the first submarine-launched ballistic missile in 1960. Theirs in 1968. Our first anti-ballistic missile was 68, and their first was 72, and so on. No nuclear weapons have been used in warfare since 1945 by any of the six nations which certainly possess them. Nevertheless, the context of conflict now must include consideration of weapons 3,000 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb. A single missile can deliver explosive power many times that of all the 2.2 million tons of bombs dropped on Germany in all of World War II. The existence of destructive power equal to 10 tons of TNT for every man, woman, and child on Earth. And the plausibility that the extinction of the human race could result from all-out nuclear war, or at least that industrial civilization might be obliterated, unlikely ever to emerge again. The basis of United States policy during that buildup had been considered to be MAD, the acronym for Mutually Assured Destruction. If either side struck first, even with all they had, the other side would be able to retaliate and smash all the instigators, major cities, and industries. To be effective as deterrence depends upon the other side believing that it cannot destroy your weapons well enough to prevent you from inflicting unacceptable retribution on them. Now, no one knows for sure what the Soviet Union considers to be unacceptable damage. Some suggest that 20 million dead like they suffered in World War II might be one measure. Further, they have to believe, whoever they are, that you have the will as well as the means to strike back. Without asking, when deterrence had failed and your own nation had been annihilated, what if there would be any purpose at all in annihilating the other nation and perhaps humanity as well? Jonathan Schell, in The Fate of the Earth, which is now available in the Holden bookstore in paperback for $2.50, puts it this way. The sole purpose of possessing nuclear strategic arms is not to win war, but to prevent it. The adoption of the aim of preventing rather than winning war requires the adoption of other policies that fly in the face of military tradition. One is abandonment of the military defense of one's nation. of what used to be at the center of all military planning and was the most hallowed justification of the military calling. The policy of deterrence does not contemplate doing anything in defense of the homeland. It only promises that if the homeland is annihilated, the aggressor's homeland will be annihilated too. In fact, the policy goes further than this. It positively requires that each side leave its population open to attack and make no serious effort to protect it. This requirement follows from the basic logic of deterrence, which is that safety is the sturdy child of terror, in Winston Churchill's words. According to this logic, the safety can be only as great as the terror is, and the terror, therefore, has to be kept relentless. If it were to be diminished by, for example, building bomb shelters that protected some significant part of the population, then safety would be diminished too, because the protected side might be tempted to launch a holocaust in the belief it could win the hostilities. That is why, in nuclear strategy, destruction must, perversely, be assured, as though our aim were to destroy and not to save humanity. In strategic terms, the requirement that the terror be perfected and never allowed to deteriorate toward safety translates into the requirement that the retaliatory force of both sides be guaranteed. First, by making sure that the retaliatory weapons cannot be destroyed in a first strike, and second, by making sure that the society of the attacking power can be destroyed in the second strike. And since in this upside-down scheme of things, the two sides will suffer equally no matter which one opens the hostilities, each side actually has an interest in maintaining its adversary's retaliatory forces as well as its own. For the most dangerous of all the configurations of forces is that in which one side appears to have the ability to destroy the nuclear forces of the other side in a first strike. Then not only is the stronger side theoretically tempted to launch hostilities, but what is probably far more dangerous, the other side, fearful of completely losing its forces, might in a crisis feel compelled to launch the first strike itself. If on either side the population becomes relatively safe from attack, or the retaliatory strike becomes vulnerable to attack, a temptation to launch a first strike is created, and stability, the leading virtue of any nuclear balance of power, is lost. As Thomas Schelling, the economist and noted nuclear theorist, has put it in The Strategy of Conflict, a book published in 1960, once instability is introduced on either side, both sides may reason as follows. He, thinking I was about to kill him in self-defense, was about to kill me in self-defense, so I had to kill him in self-defense. Under deterrence, military superiority is therefore as dangerous to the side that possesses it as it is to the side that is supposedly threatened by it. According to this logic, the United States should have heaved a sigh of relief when the Soviet Union reached nuclear parity with it, for then stability was achieved. All these conclusions follow from the deterrence doctrine. Yet they run so consistently counter to the far simpler, more familiar, and emotionally more comprehensible logic of traditional military thinking, not to mention instinct and plain common sense, which rebel against any such notion as assuring our own annihilation, that we should not be surprised when we find that the deterrence doctrine is constantly under challenge from traditional doctrine, no matter how glaringly at odds with the facts traditional doctrine may be. The hard-won gains of deterrence, such as they are repeatedly threatened by a recrudescence of the old desire for victory, for national defense in the old sense, and for military superiority, even though one of these goals would not only add nothing to our security, but, if it should be pursued far enough, would undermine the precarious safety that the deterrence doctrine tries to provide. On August 7th of 1980, our local Tacoma newspaper, which is abbreviated the TNT, reported that President Carter has signed a new directive that modifies the strategy the United States would use in fighting a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The new strategy involves placing less emphasis on all-out retaliation against Soviet cities in the event of Russian attack, MAD, mutually assured destruction. Instead, there is to be greater emphasis on destroying Soviet military forces and both political and military command centers early in a conflict, counterforce, in hopes of convincing Moscow that it could not ultimately win a war. As the Soviet missile force grew larger than the U.S. force and as its accuracy improved, The Soviets could threaten not only U.S. cities, but U.S. land-based missiles as well. Furthermore, an appreciation grew among some specialists in this country that Soviet military doctrine did not necessarily accept the idea that a nuclear war could have no winners. Under the new strategy, the United States might no longer just fire a warning shot or an all-out salvo. Rather, it might try to quickly destroy tank divisions, military command centers, and perhaps underground shelters housing civilian leaders in the immediate attack region, to show that the thrust of the U.S. response will not be just to kill Soviets, but to prevent military victory. The United States, officials say, always has been able to hit some military targets, but is now in a better position to do so because new, more accurate weapons, such as the Navy's new Trident 1 submarine-launched missile, are now entering service along with the MK-12A warhead for the land-based Minuteman III force. Beyond that, new air-launched cruise missiles with advertised high accuracy are about to be deployed soon. Well, this counterforce idea, in fact, was not so new, according to Mother Jones. Basically, Colin Gray thinks of himself as an enlightened man. He dresses well, looks good, and votes Democratic. He has an English accent and an Oxford degree, and he supports women's rights. He's a smart man, and he has paid a lot of money to think about things in his own think tank, the National Institute for Public Policy in McLean, Virginia. What Colin Gray thinks about mostly is nuclear war. He thinks it's going to happen, and he thinks we can win it with sufficient gumption and the will to spend. Gray is not alone in his belief. Rather, he is one of the newer, younger, and more articulate members of an old school in U.S. strategic thinking, a school that describes nuclear war as not just thinkable, but winnable. Most Americans believe that nuclear war would mean the near instantaneous annihilation of mankind. This group disagrees, vehemently, vociferously. For 3 decades, they have argued their case before hostile audiences. Now, with the Reagan administration, these men, virtually a lobby for the Holocaust, are in power. Last spring, Gray and his associates in the Holocaust lobby won their greatest ideological victory when the Pentagon produced a 5-year program for the U.S. military that embodied many of their views. Portions of the 125-page document were leaked to the New York Times. As envisioned by the study, nuclear war might proceed in spasms, with both sides rushing to repair blasted cities and military facilities, only to have them destroyed by the next wave of missiles. Civilian casualties could be reduced to a few tens of millions, according to the report. The idea of winning a protracted nuclear war is absolutely crazy, says Paul Warnke, Jimmy Carter's chief strategic arms limitation talks negotiator. What that 5-year plan means is that for the first time, this utterly nutty idea is clearly spelled out as the centerpiece of American defense strategy. The notion that we could beat Russia in a full-tilt thermonuclear war was spawned more than 30 years ago in the corridors of the State Department by a courtly, fastidiously dressed man named Paul Nitze. In January 1956, Nitze spelled out his beliefs in an article for Foreign Affairs, entitled Atom Strategy and Policy. The essay created a stir, and little wonder. Nitze wrote that if the word win is used to suggest a comparison of the post-war position of one of the adversaries with the post-war position of the other adversary, it is quite possible that in a general nuclear war, one side or the other could, quote, win, unquote, decisively. According to Nitze, the West had to maintain a posture of unquestioned superiority to forestall a Soviet first strike. The greater that superiority, the greater are our chances of seeing to it that nuclear war, if it comes, is fought rationally. In the years since, Paul Nitze has held a plethora of defense jobs. He has been an assistant defense secretary, a deputy defense secretary, and secretary of the Navy. He held fast to his controversial views, and in January 1976, the anniversary of his Foreign Affairs article, Nitze wrote that, although today some of the phrases seem out of date, I believe the central points remain valid. When Nitze wrote the former article, he was nearly alone in his views. But along the way, others were converted to his thinking, and whereas Nitze once represented a fringe minority, he now represents a majority position. Frighteningly, Ronald Reagan appears to be one of his converts. For today, Paul Nitze, gentleman, statesman, and proponent of winning nuclear war, is one of Reagan's 2 chief negotiators in the strategic arms reduction talks with the Soviets. Among those with opposing views about nuclear war is a group called the Physicians for Social Responsibility, who soberly, deliberately put forth this position. As physicians, scientists, and concerned citizens, alarmed by an international climate that increasingly presents nuclear war as a rational possibility, we are impelled to renew a warning based on medical and scientific analyses that, one, nuclear war, even a limited one, would result in death, injury, and disease on a scale that has no precedent in the history of human existence. Two, medical disaster planning for nuclear war is meaningless. There is no possible effective medical response. Most hospitals would be destroyed. Most medical personnel dead or injured. Most supplies unavailable. Most survivors would die. Three, there is no effective civil defense. The blast, thermal, and radiation effects would kill even those in shelters, and the fallout would reach those who had been evacuated. Four, recovery from nuclear war would be impossible. The economic, ecologic, and social fabric on which human life depends would be destroyed in the U.S., the USSR, and much of the rest of the world. Five, in sum, there can be no winners in a nuclear war. Worldwide fallout would contaminate much of the globe for generations, and atmospheric effects would severely damage all living things. So say the Physicians for Social Responsibility. The Los Angeles Times last January reported that the Reagan administration had decided to revive the nation's dormant civil defense program as part of its goal of attaining a nuclear warfighting capability to counter the alleged threat of a Soviet nuclear attack. The program adopted by the administration, which would require substantial spending increases, claims to be able to save 80% of the American population in an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. In pushing for the program, President Reagan personally intervened to overrule his Office of Management and Budget Staff and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. OMB officials argued that the program had been planned hastily and could end up costing $10 billion in the next 5 years. Jones believed the money could be better spent on other defense items. The new civil defense program, which in its first stage involves planning for the evacuation of the urban population from U.S. cities to primitive anti-radiation fallout shelters in the countryside, was drawn up by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, an independent federal agency. February, a Tacoma paper reported similarly that the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Strategic and Nuclear Forces said that with proper civil defense, it would take only 2 to 4 years for the United States to fully recover from an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. An article in Esquire magazine in March 1982, "How would the U.S. survive a nuclear war? Don't worry, our people are working on the problem right now." Following a nuclear attack on the United States, the U.S. Postal Service plans to distribute emergency change of address cards. This postage-free card, the Postal Service's emergency planning manual explains, would be used by displaced survivors of an attack to notify the Postal Service of their emergency mailing addresses. And they promised to give the utmost effort towards getting the mail forwarded. Well, where is Counterforce as of now? In March of 1981, it was reported in Chemical and Engineering News by the editor that both the United States and the Soviet Union have added an average of close to 10 bombs and warheads to their strategic nuclear arsenals every week for the past decade. This has brought the U.S. total from 4,000 in 1970 to close to 9,000 in 1981, while Soviet growth has been from 1,800 to 7,100. The total explosive yield of all these weapons is equivalent to about 10 billion tons of TNT. And the growth hasn't been only quantitative. The technological brilliance of both nations has greatly enhanced weapon sophistication. The most significant improvement has been in accuracy. This is a very disturbing development, as it means that each side is approaching the ability to strike at the other's weapons, if it can get in the first lick, which is what counterforce seems to be about. The book published in 1982, group calling themselves Ground Zero in Nuclear War, What's in It for You, assesses that at present, the Soviet Union could destroy 60 to 70% of our intercontinental ballistic missiles on a first strike. In a few years, they will be able to destroy 80 to 90%. We could destroy about 40% of theirs now. We're planning to try for 80 to 90% capability with either 200 MX missiles, if we could decide how best to deploy them, or 200 Trident II missiles, that's not 200 submarines, but 200 missiles for those submarines, which would have comparable accuracy with the MX missile to destroy a hardened silo containing, presumably, a missile which has not yet been fired, since there would seem to be little point in destroying an empty silo that had been emptied on a first strike. And it's for this reason that many people claim that the United States is trying to achieve first strike capability, and the United States has not indicated. Well, it depends on how good you are at it. If you could destroy the enemy's early warning and communication satellites first, so they wouldn't be sure what was going on. If you had extremely accurate missiles and bombers that could hit all their silos. If you had anti-submarine capability to sink all their nuclear missile-carrying submarines. If you had a missile and bomber defense that would stop any of theirs that you didn't get before they set them off, and if you had a command, control, and communications network that you could pull all these things off at the same time, then first strike might not be. Well, there is a great deal of difference of opinion on that question, and I'd like to come back to that kind of question on closing.
Only percussion evidence that they don't mention is the fact that if you blow up a city, there are going to be numbers of people who are not killed. There's no food. They're going to go out of the farm country looking for food, and if the farmer tries to defend what he got, he just gets killed.
Exactly.
So when there's things done, there's no farmers, there's no nothing. So how do you expect to? I don't know if any of you ever read Philip Gibbs wrote a book on that. He went and projected 25 years down the road and bowed to his puppet, and the whole thing was going to do this. If the theory was 25 of the big cities of space were hit, if you hit 25 of the big cities in this country 25 years from now, you won't recognize them if you know it. No way.
And that was the concept of the mutually assured destruction, that if they did it to us, we would certainly do it to them, and neither side could possibly benefit from such an exchange. The first strike capability would assume we could do that to them without their being able to do it to us. And to do that, you have to have not only very powerful weapons, which have been in existence for a long time, but very accurate ones that can actually hit their other weapons in the silo. As far as the necessity for an anti-ballistic missile defense, in 1972, the United States and the Soviet Union signed a treaty where, under the concept of the deterrence, both sides renounced developing anti-ballistic missiles. Well, limiting it to, say, 100 to protect one population center or one military base. The ones which the United States put in to detect military base have since been dismantled. And that has been one of the reasons for the tradition of civilian control at the top rather than having all of the decisions made by the military personnel who will spend the appropriations if they get them. Now, the figures I did read indicate that the Soviet Union at present has a better counterforce capability against intercontinental ballistic missiles than we have. They could destroy a higher percentage of ours right now than we could of theirs. What those figures do not include is the consideration that the Soviet Union has the great majority of their strategic weapons in the form of intercontinental ballistic missiles in land-based silos and relatively few submarine-based. And the bombers which they have appear to be of such a range that if they attack the United States using the backfire bomber, it would be a one-way mission, not a round trip.
Are you assuming that where we are, you know all?
No. I'm not assuming that either. Least of all that I know all. However, I would say from what I have read that it is not possible for anyone on Earth to launch a large missile without the knowledge of the United States. The heat that comes from such a missile launch can be detected and would be detected unless the first act were to knock out that detection capability of our satellites. It is unlikely that a nation would choose to carry out a first strike with completely untested weapons. This is just speculation on my part.
Is it true, Bill, that the United States is no longer saying that we would not strike first?
I don't know that we ever did say that. It is certainly true that President Reagan will not say that, or has said that he does not say that.
Yeah, because if Russia could be absolutely certain the States wouldn't strike first, they'd take Western Europe, and not a thing about.
That's the other, another point of considerable difference of opinion, and part of that consideration is with another of the various weapon system. I mentioned the MX, which, as far as I know, in the most recent newspaper I've looked at, the Senate had not yet acted and was unlikely at least to give funds for deploying it, but there was some kind of a loophole mentioned. There is the Trident II missile for the submarine. Each submarine would carry 24 of those missiles to have a range of 4,500 to 6,000 miles. 17 warheads on each missile. That would mean that 408 targets could be hit, each with five times the blast of the Hiroshima bomb. Or that each sub would carry as many missiles as originally thought would be sufficient for total deterrence of being able to destroy all cities in the Soviet Union, for example, of over 100,000 population. Also, the administration was seeking to develop the Pershing II missile. It would have a 1,000-mile range to be based in West Germany, puts it on targets within the Soviet Union. And along with what you were saying, Helmut Kohl, the new chancellor of West Germany, said in an interview published in Time magazine on November 15th on the possible deployment of new intermediate range missiles in West Germany, "We will abide by our commitment, and we shall do so with the consent of the vast majority of the people. Of course, there will be resistance, perhaps even major resistance, but we will still do it. It is not the West, it is not the Americans that have started the arms race. It is the Soviet Union that keeps on arming, that keeps on deploying batteries of SS-20 missiles. We have now come to a point when we in the West say this far and no farther. We are not arming with a view to waging war. We have been forced to meet this challenge to be able to defend our peace and freedom. Nuclear arms, terrible as they may be in themselves, by their sheer existence have preserved peace in Europe for the past 35 years. So he's saying just what you said, that it's our expressed willingness to be the first to use them in cases where conventional weapons would not be a deterrent. That is the deterrent, and which gives many West Europeans then the concern that if the United States thinks that a limited nuclear war could be waged, that Europe would be the place it would most likely be waged, and they're not uncomfortable, and they are quite uncomfortable with that aspect of our strategy. And that's a point of view which many people agree with you on, too. Yes?
France and Britain also, they have the bomber. They have two other
Yes.
Nations. They're, now, as France isn't a part of NATO, is it? I'm just wondering, you know, we talk about us and Russians, we also have other nuclear forces in Europe. I'm just wondering how they enter in to our counterforce, or whether there's any joint command, or whether they'd have their own decision on how they would respond.
Well, I think the French keep control of their own. Britons are part of NATO. The French nuclear force of 80 submarine-launched ballistic missiles, 18 land-based missiles, and 24 medium bombers could probably destroy the 30 largest Soviet cities, 25 million people, in a first strike. If the Soviet Union attacked the French first, few, if any, of the land-based missiles and bombers would survive, but all French submarines at sea would probably survive. Thus, if two or three of the five submarines, 64 to 80, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, were at sea, a retaliatory attack by the French could probably destroy the top 15 to 20 Soviet cities, 15 to 20 million people. The British nuclear force of 64 SLBMs and 40 medium bombers has about the same capability as the French, destruction of 30 Soviet cities in a first strike and 15 to 20 Soviet cities in a retaliatory strike. Again, how much deterrence is considered to be adequate depends on the thinking of the other side. Yes?
On this topic of us retaining first strike because of the Soviet Union's superior conventional forces in Europe, last week the Soviet Union, they said that they would not be the first to use nuclear weapons, and then last week they said they would also not be the first to use conventional forces.
What does a statement like that have to do with it, though?
No.
I mean, we don't even believe our own government. Why should we believe Soviet government? I mean, I think that's what's ridiculous. We tend to believe the Russians more than we believe our own government. We have a right to, you know, challenge a lot of things our government says, but then we turn around and believe what the Russians say.
Roxy?
Well, I don't think we ought to forget that we have used nuclear weapons in war, and we are the only nation that has used nuclear weapons in war. So I believe, yes, the United States would use nuclear weapons in war.
You know, this whole discussion or the whole counterforce just, to me, is just speaks so strongly of our idolatry. But that's where we're putting our trust. It's just incredible that we think, pragmatically speaking, we have to do this.
But when in the world history has not a nation had that idolatry? Not saying that it's good any time, but...
Well, I would just like to be part of...
Now is the time when we have become idolatrous. I don't know of a nation on earth.
Well, Werner, this is the biggest idol that we've ever worshipped. A bomb, a Trident submarine that has the capability of destroying. I mean, one submarine is all we need for the deterrence that we said we were going to have. And I mean, the idol is so big, and it's getting bigger and bigger. It's just, we just don't know how to trust God anymore. And I want to be a part of a nation that says, I want to put my trust back where it belongs, not in this hideous weapons.
But why is the Trident submarine more idolatrous than conventional weapons?
Because it can destroy.
That conventional weapons, we're not putting our trust in God either.
Well, I don't, you know.
I'd like to respond to the difference, the actual qualitative difference as many people see it since 1945 compared to previous human history, of which there are many, in which there are many things, of course, not to be proud of, too. And that is the possible consequences of a miscalculation are unprecedented. And under the heading Possible Consequences, Jonathan Schell has this to say at much greater length. If in a nuclear holocaust there were those that hid themselves deep enough under the earth and stayed there long enough to survive, they would emerge into a dying natural environment in an all-out nuclear war, since there is certainly the possibility that a limited nuclear war could become an all-out nuclear war. The vulnerability of the environment is the last word in the argument against the usefulness of shelters. There is no hole big enough to hide all of nature in. In a 10,000 megaton attack, which would create levels of radiation around the country averaging more than 10,000 rads, most of the mammals of the United States would be killed off. The lethal doses for birds are in roughly the same range as those for mammals, and birds too would be killed off. The one class of animals containing a number of species quite likely to survive, at least in the short run, is the insect class, for which in most cases the lethal doses lie between 2,000 rads and about 100,000 rads. Insects, therefore, would be destroyed selectively. Unfortunately for the rest of the environment, many of the insects that feed directly on vegetation, which include some of the most ravaging species on Earth, have very high tolerance. So they could be expected to survive disproportionately and then to multiply greatly in the aftermath of an attack. The demise of their natural predators, the birds, would enhance their success. A gamma ray dose of 10,000 rads would devastate most vegetation in the United States. Trees are among the first to die, grasses among the last. The most sensitive trees are pines and the other conifers, for which lethal doses are in roughly the same range as those for mammals. Then, after the trees had died, forest fires would break out around the United States. Because as much as three-quarters of the country could be subjected to incendiary levels of the thermal pulses, the sheer scorching of the land could have killed off a substantial part of plant life in the country in the first few seconds after the detonations, before radioactive poisoning sets in. A good deal of grass would survive, except where the attacks had been heaviest. When vegetation is killed off, the land on which it grew is degraded, eroded. In sum, a full-scale nuclear attack on the United States would devastate the natural environment on a scale unknown since early geological times, when in response to natural catastrophes whose nature has not been determined, sudden mass extinctions of species and whole ecosystems occurred all over the Earth. How far this gross simplification of the environment would go, once virtually all animal life and the greater part of plant life had been destroyed, and what patterns the surviving remnants of life would arrange themselves into over the long run, are imponderables. But it appears that at the outset, the United States would be a republic of insects and grass. Bearing in mind that the possible consequences of the detonations of thousands of megatons of nuclear explosives include the blinding of insects, birds, and beasts all over the world, the extinction of many ocean species, among them some at the base of the food chain, The temporary or permanent alteration of the climate of the globe, with the outside chance of dramatic and major alterations in the structure of the atmosphere, the pollution of the whole ecosphere with oxides of nitrogen, the incapacitation in 10 minutes of unprotected people who go out into the sunlight after the ozone layer is affected, the blinding of people who go out into the sunlight, a significant decrease in photosynthesis in plants around the world, the scalding and killing of many crops, the increase in rates of cancer and mutation around the world, but especially in the targeted zones, and the attendant risk of global epidemics, the possible poisoning of all vertebrates by sharply increased levels of vitamin D in their skin as a result of increased ultraviolet light, and the outright slaughter on all targeted continents of most human beings and other living things by the initial nuclear radiation, the fireballs, the thermal pulses, the blast waves, the mass fires, and the fallout from the explosions, and considering that these consequences will all interact with one another in unguessable ways, and furthermore are in all likelihood an incomplete list, which will be added to as our knowledge of the Earth increases, one must conclude that a full-scale nuclear holocaust could lead to the extinction of humanity.